Hello, everybody, and welcome to Queens of the Bees. I am your podcast co-host, homosexual Mark Muster.
And I'm your co-host, Pisces, writer, and card-carrying faggot, TJ.
I lost my card.
We'll get another one in the mail.
When I didn't know who Delta Burke was last week.
Yes, you'll have to do some penance to get yours back. Probation.
I'm gonna leave that there and let the listeners think about that. Anyway, we're here to talk about the 2004 film Brother to Brother.
I had never seen it before, but we chose it because we did want to do something in honor of Black History Month, which is this month, February. So It's a well-regarded film that was very well-received at the time, and it seemed like a good option, especially considering, as we'll talk about in a bit, it's very political and subtle and sophisticated arguments about artistry and queerness.
Yeah, and it has a stacked cast, and it is also pretty artistic in its portrayal, I think, in a really good way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so TJ, why don't you give us a 25 words or less summary of Brother to Brother?
Oh, I get 25 words this time?
Yes, now you get 25. Okay. Because I couldn't do it at 15, and...
I know, but I'm better at summarizing than you are, so...
Okay.
All right, so let's see. So young college student meets former... Harlem Renaissance painter, writer. Flashbacks ensue. Discussions about art also take place.
16, I think that was.
Yeah,
you had so many other words.
I know, but I feel like,
I mean, you forgot. Yeah, go ahead.
But I feel like that captured the essence of the film.
I mean, I guess you forgot some of the main themes. You know, black masculinity, queerness.
Well, yeah, but it's a summary, not a thematic summary. It's a plot summary.
Oh, I didn't realize that we were subsectioning different kinds of summaries. I wouldn't know because I'm so terrible at them.
I think most people assume that summary means plot summary.
Okay, whatever.
Okay, so to start off our discussion this week, we thought we'd just dive in right at the deep end, and we don't want to privilege whiteness in a film that is very straightforwardly about black experience, and particularly about black queer experience, but first of all, we have to say what's obvious is that in this movie, as in real life, white gay men are sort of awful, because one of the key plot points that I did not mention in the intro is that Perry, who's played by Anthony Mackie, who most people are familiar with from the Marvel Universe, has a dalliance with one of his fellow students who is white, and I think first things seem to be going okay, and so at one point, the white lover says something along the effects of, your skin is so beautiful and so smooth, and your face is beautiful, your lips are beautiful, and you have this beautiful black ass, and I just cringed when I heard it. I cringed for two reasons. One, because it's just a cringeworthy thing to say. But also because it's something that I probably would have also been guilty of saying at some point, and I'm not proud of that. But at the very least, I recognize that that is a problem. Mm-hmm. And I applaud the film for being able to make it clear that that kind of racial fetishizing is woefully offensive. And I actually feel like offensive isn't even the right word. It's just deeply reprehensible. Because it reduces Perry and obviously all black men who have been the object of white male fetishizing to nothing more than objects. And I just think that that's one of those things about this film, though it was made 17 years ago, that still seems and feels startlingly and depressingly relevant, given the way in which white men still routinely fetishize black bodies. And specifically, they itemize the body. Like they, you know, they say, you could see this on the blog where I have a post about this, but the way that Grindr is full of, you know, white gays being like, I want to be wrecked by a BBC or, you know, whatever. And I just think that, as I said, that's just one of those things that feels still very relevant and that makes this film feel even more timely than it may have felt at the time.
Okay. So let me back up a little bit. So the base of the movie, as TJ said, was that Perry meets Bruce Nugent, who is a famous Harlem Renaissance painter and writer who was openly gay at the time, and it was kind of very controversial, you know. And this guy kind of becomes a confidant to him and is leading him through the history of the Harlem Renaissance from his perspective through actual flashbacks that we get to watch and experience, and also through stories. But he often asks Perry about the white gay kid that he's dating, whose name I forget, and kind of helps him through his dilemma with this kid. But I love that Perry basically breaks it off with him by just like kind of sitting him down and saying, you know, I don't think we're looking for the same things. I'm looking for someone to love me. He's claiming a humanity that was denied him when someone is like, oh, I love your black ass, right? He's just kind of exemplifying it to this kid as a way of saying, I'm worth something and I'm looking for this. And it was really good. It was just so well done. I really liked it.
Yeah, and what struck me as I watched it is I wanted to just shake the white kid and be like, couldn't you just said ass? Like, it would, like, why did you have to add the descriptor of color? Because I think that from the white guy's perspective, as it is for many clueless white men, which is to say most of them, mm-hmm. is that they look at this as a compliment. They think, I have just, you know, I'm complimenting you and working against the tradition, you know, the sort of the use of black skin as a pejorative and using it instead as a praise, but not recognizing the way in which they're still participating in a rhetorical strategy that works to dehumanize the black body.
Yeah, and it's a position of supremacy, right? To be like, yeah. Oh, I'm taking this thing and
making it. Yeah, I mean, like, and, you know, I don't, the film isn't nearly as harshly critical as of a white kid as we are being, but I think that's...
Yeah, but I also think that that's the film's boon to give to us.
Right, exactly. You know? And I think mm-hmm. that it's subtle in that it shows the white guy's, he seems genuinely confused about it. But I also think this whole incident just highlights the way in which Perry, like, sort of exists in this weird liminal space. And as I watched this film, I was continually reminded of Marlon Riggs. I'm sure you have heard of him, who was a very famous... of
Red, yeah, right. Wash. I know who Marlon Riggs is. Jesus Christ, TJ. I have been to graduate school.
But for our listeners who may not be familiar, Marlon Riggs is a very, very famous black queer filmmaker of the 80s and I think early 90s, right? Was he still alive in the 90s, I think?
I think he died in the early 90s.
Yeah, so, you know, was famously, you know, his work explored the fraught position that many black men feel because they're rejected or fetishized by white men and often rejected for a number of reasons by their fellow black men who are straight. So I really, that's what the sort of the, I think, lurking in the background of this was that that tradition of black queer filmmaking. And the film doesn't necessarily make any explicit reference to Marlon, but that's what kept coming up in my mind, especially during that conversation.
It's also interesting because this fetishization of the black body by a white gay man is very subset to the plot of the film, which I really like, especially mm-hmm. because, you know, we go through a lot of films where the plot is dating or like love, right? Whereas this is more about black queer history, right, and black queer intimacy that is touched by fetishization of by white men, but is also not the main point of it, right? It's
yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that sort of struck me as I was watching, and as I finished watching it, was, you know, I'm one of those queer viewers who tends to invest a lot in romantic queer movies, like those are the ones that I seek out, the ones that move me the most. But I was really struck by how moved I was by this movie, because the romance plot is really so second or even tertiary. Like, it's really not about queer. It's about, as you say, about queer love and queer intimacy, but not queer romance per se.
Correct.
And I found that really just wonderful. And I found the profound bond between Bruce and Perry to be so affective. Like, I just found myself really moved by the way in which, you know, this queer elder who is homeless and has, as he points out to Perry, has been homeless for a long time because it's hard being a writer and a queer writer and a black writer. It's not exactly a lucrative position to be in. And so I found that maybe it's because I'm getting older and becoming I'm not obviously like Bruce Nugent age, but I am getting older and I have a different perspective about these kinds of things. And so maybe that's part of the reason that I found it so moving in that regard.
Yeah. Well, you brought up one of my favorite topics that I want to talk about. I loved the way that they portrayed the romanticization of the starving artist in this movie, film, I should say, because it was so... it exemplified it by showing us how much fun Bruce Nugent had in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance, with all these people living in the same house, writing together, having sex, having parties, getting drunk. There's a real love, but at that same time, we move back to reality, and we're always kind of reminded that, you know, this bohemian lifestyle has a real toll. Bruce kind of talks about how, you know, he sleeps on floors and in hallways now, right? And he was like, well, back then we used to sleep on floors and in hallways too. That is very powerful.
I mean, Mark and I, as we were talking for the pregame during the
the pregame.
Sorry, I'm in Super Bowl mode. Not really. don't ever think I give a shit about the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, we were in the sort of the pre mode, and we were talking about how we each did or did not like the flashbacks to the 1920s and 30s, and I liked them for a number of reasons. First of all, I found them just to be beautifully shot because they're in black and white, and so I'm a sucker for those kinds of stylistic flourishes. But I also just found them to be sort of haunting and almost elegiac, partially because of the sort of saxophone heavy, almost jazzy, not and the sort of sad end of jazz, like the sort of more morose kind of jazz or that orchestration that you sometimes hear that sort of overlays those earlier sequences. But also the fact that, you know, that Bruce takes Perry back to Harlem, because Perry's from Brooklyn, as he says. So, you know, they literally revisit these spaces that and in the present that Bruce once inhabited, which are now basically abandoned buildings. So there is this profound sense that this earlier moment of queer flourishing, when you had these, you know, beautiful queer artists, Langston Hughes and Bruce himself and Zora Neale Hurston and all these people like sort of living it up in this moment of great queer flourishing, queer black flourishing. Mm-hmm. And but then you see it in the present where that history has been effaced or forgotten or literally abolished, because there's also a sequence where we see the sort of respectability contingent of black politics burn their work in front of them and spit on it and be like, this is not what we want to be doing as black people. And so there's this profound sort of sad elegiac mourning for a past, for a queer past that has been obliterated, that I think the film captures really well in those flashbacks. Because we see a young Bruce who's young and vibrant and full of energy, and you see all the, you know, the sort of beautiful people that were just making the most out of life during this brief period. That runs from the 20s to the 30s before the Depression, and I just think that that's one of those things that the flashbacks capture really perfectly, and that also dovetails with the present struggles that Perry has, where, you know, earlier it was queerness versus respectability politics. Now it's queerness being juxtaposed and dominated to some degree by black politics focused on black advocacy and fighting back against police violence, without, you know, recognizing that queerness is still essential to the civil rights struggle. And that black queer people have made huge contributions, both in terms of artistry, but also in terms of activism, since the beginning. And so I think that that's one of those really wonderful things that the film does exquisitely well, is to braid together past and present, interweaving these powerful and emotionally resonant flashbacks with the sort of more jarring things of the present.
Yeah, and it definitely, you know, we talked about this before too, it has a very unique way of being intersectional, which I really like, in terms of, you know, Bruce eventually near the end talks about, because as all great queer moments, they never last, right? And the being in there, them kind of living in those dead spaces, reviving them too by just being in them together, it's really powerful when Perry kind of tries to touch those spaces in the present as well. Like, you know, he has an art exhibition, and a wealthy white gallery owner from Chelsea comes to, and he goes to talk to him, who his friend introduces him to, and he's like, Perry's not about it. He doesn't want to get involved in his, and he says, you know, I don't want to change my art for, like, you know, the white man, or like, kind of, you know, he's like, has this kind of rebellious spirit. But his friend is very realistically being like, if you want to eat, this is what you need to do. And it's kind of figuring out how to navigate that space. And, you know, you can go down the starving artist route, but then you see what being a starving artist actually means, right? If you want to compromise your work. And there was a reason why I brought this up. Oh, because Bruce talks about how the reason, one of the reasons why their queer kind of fantasy ended was the world changed in another way too. You know, when the Depression came and people started, like, the ways that working was understood, that they weren't working enough, right? That leisure, writing, art was morphed into a decadence, but that the world kind of cracked down on creativity and art and beauty in a certain way. And that I find so relevant to today when we think about how much more the world has changed, right? And how much, I would not even say how much more creativity is considered a decadence, right? And how much more we're expected to work. Things like that.
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, speaking of artistic production and, you know, white fetishizing, the interesting way in which the film also juxtaposes, you know, Perry's white lovers fetishizing his body with the idea of white cultural producers fetishizing black cultural production, but wanting to render it palatable mm-hmm. to white audiences. And so asking to strip it of whatever gives it its richness and authenticity. And there's a particularly, like, powerful conversation between Zora Neale Hurston and her, a potential white publisher who's like, well, if you, you know, we want to make it a little more accessible and all this other stuff by, it doesn't go into a lot of detail, but suggests that part of it is stripping out the black vernacular. Mm-hmm. And she says, this is what my people speak. Like, you can't ask me to make this kind of change. And, you know, that's something that's still very much relevant for our listeners who might have seen Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the mm-hmm. recent film with Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman, is also about that similar contest and the similar way in which white cultural owners of white cultural venues mm-hmm. continually like try to, and I would even say even today to some degree, not as much as before, but certainly try to enforce their vision of what is saleable and sellable to white mm-hmm. consuming publics. And I think that that's one thing that the film that Brother to Brother does well and draws a specific parallel between that and the way in which whites also fetishize black bodies and try to use them for their own purposes.
Yeah, it is almost unseen too, which is fascinating, especially when, you know, you think about how people experience art. They're told that this is blackness, or mm-hmm. that they're told that this is queerness, you know, or anything like that. And to see how much an original intent by an artist has changed because we live in a world where it needs to sell, and how that can be damaging to the ideas of blackness and queerness, right? It's very powerful, because the film, as a piece of black queer art,
right,
is exposing that for us to look at, to remember when we experience other things.
Right, and I'm reminded of our conversation way back in our first episode of this podcast, where we were talking about Shelter and the sort of connection between queerness and artistic production. And, you know, it's a stereotype perhaps to say that queer people are, you know, innately artistic, but I do think there is something to be said that living in a subaltern position or living in a crossways experience to mainstream culture does encourage and allow us to experience in the world in ways that are sometimes difficult and painful, but also full of great joy. And I think that's one of the things that this film manages also to capture, is that mingling, that you never lose sight of the fact that, you know, for Bruce's generation, it wasn't just, you know, this halcyon day when everyone loved queerness. That's very clearly not the case. You know, he gets arrested, in a bathroom by federal, by an agent, like, bleh, by vice squad. Mm-hmm. You know, there is that, as I said, that scene where a lot of the plot leaders are burning the magazine that Bruce and his fellows found, you know.
Fire. Yeah.
Yeah, fire. And, you know, as he points out, like, lots of them died young, like Wally, mm-hmm. Whose name I can't remember. One of the artists from his period, from he grew up with, died at 34 or 32, mm-hmm. actually, in real life. But even mm-hmm. so, it's like, so there is great pain in Bruce's past. And I think that's one of the things that the actor who portrays him captures really well, is that sense of a man who has endured great tragedy, but also great joy. And I think that that's, does anything define queerness more than that? I mean, I ask that question in all seriousness. I think that that's one of the things that makes queerness very difficult, but also very pleasurable to be part of, is that mm-hmm. those two things that are all, I mean, obviously all human experience is structured like that. But I think mm-hmm. for queer people, it's taken to an even greater extreme. And I think that it takes a lot to keep those things together and not go crazy.
it almost gave us an excuse to love our lives on the fringes, you know, however on the fringes you really are, you know, because they are, you know, the best part about how the as they call them, the bourgeois black people, mm-hmm. right, who discount their sexualized and pieces of art, right? And Fire is the magazine that Langston and Zora and Bruce start together, right? They what was I really trying to say? It shows like you said, the ecstasy in good and bad ways of living life all the way at the fringes, right? They are mm-hmm. still that when, you know, we never get to forget that that is the life that they live, and that comes with happiness and sadness at the same time.
Right, because we see all these scenes in the flashbacks of, like, you know, Bruce making out with men, of, you know, them all having these lovely, what we would normally think of as sort of, like, the typical 20s, roaring 20s decadent mm-hmm. parties.
Dalliances, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. dalliances, you know, there's no sense of rootedness, but that's part of the joy, is that you just keep going. Like, you just mm-hmm. you just flit about the room and make out with whatever boys happen to be there.
Yes.
And so I think that's just one of those moments where it really encapsulates the happiness of queer identity and queer life, but mm-hmm. in a group of people who are outcasts, as we mentioned earlier, because of the intersectional nature of queer black life, have literally just had to sort of carve out their own space and yeah. their own place where they can be both queer and black, and mm-hmm. you know, with all the contradictions that entails, because white mm-hmm. culture rejects them because of their blackness, black culture rejects them because of their queerness, and they have to sort of meet in this middle space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the best part about the film too is that we move then to present day in the film, where Perry is going through that same issue, right? He's in a college class where he meets, talk about fetishization, but the only white boy in the class of this, which is black literary and history class, is the guy he ends up having sex with. But he has, like, I guess a nemesis in the class who is a very off-putting, and he has a very off-putting attitude towards the queer things that they read in the class. So they start in the intro scene, it's the class, they're reading James Baldwin, and he's talking about homosexuality in the black community. That exemplification kind of hasn't gone away, right? The film is very much expressing that. And eventually, I don't know if I love this part, and we can argue about it, but Perry gets beaten up by the same kid in class. And it's almost as though, like, I think it's to show that those dichotomies are still there in the community, which is, of course, true. But I also think that he ends up becoming a stereotype, I think. I think the film is kind of being like, there is no nuance to this young man who is clearly homophobic. But there's no nuance, I think, given to the other side of that, the homophobia in the black community, mm-hmm. right? Which is fine. It's only one film. But I think it's interesting, you know, and it ends up going a little further than I would have liked, where, like, you know, he burns his cigarette on Perry's neck and it beats him up, and it's not really explained. It's just kind of, like, put there.
Yeah.
And it's not given a lot of due, but it is a good way to exemplify things that haven't changed so much, or that it's still an ongoing issue, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And I mean, I too found that to be just a bit heavy handed. And also because it just doesn't get a lot of resolution. Like,
right.
There's no, like, confrontation with this person who's done this violent act. It's just Perry holds up in his room until Bruce comes and finds him and drags him out to do the painting session that they were going to do. I do agree with you. Like, I think its purpose narratively and thematically is to suggest how little things have actually changed, or more like how the dichotomy, the struggle for black queer representation within mainstream black political organizing exists. Terrain has shifted, but mm-hmm. yet the same struggle remains. Again, I don't know that they needed to have him be, like, gay bashed, basically, to make that point. Especially since it seems so it just seems unmotivated. Like, okay, so you had some disagreements in class, so you're gonna hunt him down in Harlem. Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I'm just like, so you find him on a random street in Harlem. I mean, it just didn't quite make a lot of narrative sense.
It is the early 2000s. It's a little more homophobic at the time, I will also say. So I mean, not that violence doesn't happen in our community,
right?
Now.
But it's more established as part of how to represent queer life.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. But I also think that I had a point. Oh, but you know, that is part of Bruce's function as our listeners may know, Bruce Nugent died in the 80s, and this film clearly takes place in the 2000s. Like, or even maybe the late 90s at the most.
Yeah.
So, but that's beside the point. Like, he serves this purpose of being this rather intergenerational figure to help literalize queer history, because his body bears the marks of that queer history. And his purpose is to help Harry to understand these things.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I'm reading, for Queer Book Club, we're reading my autobiography of Carson McCullers, which is about trying to figure out queer lineage through this lesbian author in the early 1900s. And I found queer lineage is also, a big issue in our lives, just in general. And I love that that Bruce is giving Perry a queer lineage through friendship. It's very it's very interesting that, like, because you can have him just learn about Bruce Nugent, but instead Bruce Nugent is real in a fictional way because he was dead at this time, right? And their bond, the friendship between these two black men is how a queer lineage of black activism culture is shared, which is kind of really beautiful, because it creates an intimacy, right? Because there's a contrast between the class on black literature and history that he's taking and the education about black literary history that he gets from Bruce. Those are two different, those are explored with, explained to us in two different ways. Right? In the classroom, Perry meets with the problems of homophobia in the black community. He kind of is stulted in his learning while he's there. But with a friend, someone just kind of to walk around Harlem with and physically engage in these spaces as opposed to just being in a classroom, right? Living in some ways or reliving those moments, from the Harlem Renaissance, gives him not just the history of about how much queerness is embedded within black culture, but black civil rights, excuse me, but that part of queer lineage is also about intimacy, I guess is what I'm really trying to say, that it needs to be lived, you know, not just learned, which I think is really kind of sweet. I just got chills. I gave myself chills thinking of that.
Yeah, that's a good line. I like that. And I also think that, you know, the sequences that we get with Bruce's flashbacks to the 20s and 30s are sharply juxtaposed to the flashbacks that Perry himself has of his own relationship with his father and mother. Cause those sequences, unlike, so Bruce's sequences are very much, as I've said already, like saturated with nostalgia and, you know, sort of melancholy. That's the word I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Sort of melancholia. But yet profoundly moving and again, sort of narratively self-sustaining and coherent. Whereas Perry's violent expulsion from his family, where his father kicks him and throws him out of the house, and his mother is like, what did we do wrong? You know, aside from being very, you know, true to life, where unfortunately large number of queer people are also just sort of disjointed. Like they're deeply, clearly deeply traumatic for Perry. And they're presented as being disjointed. We don't really get a full sense of what happened exactly. And so I think that's his way of contending with that. In the same way that Bruce is somewhat engaging with his own traumatic memories of the past, in the sense that, but for Bruce, obviously, they were less traumatic in that sense, but more just sad at what has been lost.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's really interesting you bring up the idea that there are two methods of flashback in the film. Perry's flashbacks, which, as you say, are caused by trauma. So they seem disjointed. We get them in blips. We have to put the full story together. Whereas Bruce's flashbacks are chronological almost. They are very expository. Like you say, they're very beautiful. They're in black and white. And I think it's so interesting to put those two things in comparison when we think about queer lineage and we think about history, because Perry's literal history is a history a lot of queer people go through and understand, but it is being more documented, right? But it is much more an experience of trauma. Whereas Bruce's history is literary. It has capital H history as a part of it. And so it gets to be beautifully rendered for us to experience, right? And because of that, But what's interesting too is that Bruce does suffer that trauma, and we live that through him existing mm-hmm. as a, you know, a homeless artist, who has his own kind of, you know, he, like you said, he has a sad aura about him, so much so that when he meets Perry, he kind of gets very excited, and he goes to meet an old friend at a bar, and he kind of talks about how he, you know, Perry, a curious young black man thinking about his past and what it kind of means to be black and gay, makes him excited again. He's like, oh, it's like as though I wanted to hold this person. And it's not a sexual interest. It's just a queer interest.
Yeah. And so the moment that strikes me the most about that encounter with his friend at the bar is he's like, do you ever get the feeling like you look at your hand and you think, how is it possible that, you know, my spirit, which is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, my young spirit is in this old body. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow. Like, I mean, that just hits you in a way. As I said, maybe I'm just more attuned to this because
I wouldn't know.
You will, my child. But I mean, but in all seriousness, it's like, it's one of those moments where, like, I have a profound respect for queer elders. Mm. And I think that's one of the moments that I think helps make that possible. Or it forces us to acknowledge the real value and, I guess the value, that's what I'll say, the value of queer elders and like and the importance of establishing connections with them and talking with them about a history that may otherwise be lost.
Right.
Because who else is to tell it if not them?
Right. And I mean, as we've said before, you know, the millennial generation is one of the largest queer generations to exist, and where right. you are aging now. so you will be our queer elders. We will all be queer elders. And it's a whole new territory.
Yep.
To think about how one might behave. But I'm kind of getting off topic because we must talk about the art in this.
Yes. We can talk about the art, and then we can also talk about the since you mentioned the SD, the standard definition, the feel of this film, let me put it that way, the sort of the affective texture of this film. Like it's the way in which it has this film felt 2004. I don't know how any more sophisticated way of putting it than that. I feel rather flummoxed because I'm a film scholar, so I should have a more sophisticated vocabulary for how to put this, but it just felt very 2004. And that's a good way. I mean, I think that part of it's the music, part of it's the cinematography, that it's clearly a film that's not it's not on a shoestring budget. So it's not like Make the Yuletide Gay, which Mark elaborated on. But yet it's not like Moonlight. Like it's not a big budget Hollywood production.
Holiday. That's Make the Yuletide Gay. You're getting confused, TJ.
Yeah. So it's somewhere in between. So it has the marks and the feel and the texture and the cinematography of a 2004 independent queer movie. And I think that gives it a certain, to my mind, emotional power that other sort of big budgets do not have. Because at the time, that's largely what we had, was, with some exceptions, obviously, like Brokeback, which comes out very shortly thereafter. But, yeah. You know, that's what we had.
Yeah, the texture of the film reminded me a lot of, and I'll give you an example as to maybe what you're trying to say. So it reminds me a lot of The Watermelon Woman mm-hmm. and the idea that like you're trying to portray industry and cityscape and kind of in a very specific way, very amateur video-esque, which touches, you know, the amateurity of understanding your queerness, and a curiosity almost, which is very much the themes in both those films, actually.
Yep.
Well, this film and Watermelon Woman. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, that you feel a little younger in a metaphoric and literal sense,
right,
because of the way the film is textured by that.
Right, because it has...
It doesn't have that gloss of Brokeback, right, you know, or exactly, like a Moonlight. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, can we talk about the art now?
Please? Yes, please.
Okay. So this is my favorite... it could be my favorite scene. This is after Perry gets beaten up by his classmate, and Bruce comes to find him in his dorm room and basically drags him out because he said, Perry earlier had said that he would pose for Bruce in the old house that Bruce lived in during the Harlem Renaissance. And so he drags him out there and they go, and it's just so Perry, for context, Perry is also studying painting and art at school, so the two of them decide to paint each other, and so Perry sits shirtless while Bruce paints him in the abandoned, in like the top floor of the abandoned brownstone in Harlem. And then Perry does the same. And it's like the closest thing to sex that this movie was going to get. But in like a, in a good way, you know, the intimacy is so paramount, and you can see it in the artistic pieces as well. Just, and it's just their faces. They do the, and it's like, the style is gorgeous, and they really give soul to this moment in the film. And what, of course, marks it as such a great moment is that they sleep on the floor together after they're done painting, and Perry wakes up and finds that Bruce has died while they were in the night. And it's the full resolution of a story in which, you know, Bruce finally got to experience again one of the happiest moments of his life, making art with another young Black man who, you know, they have a deep friendship with. And when he got to do that one last time is when he dies, right? It's just so fucking beautiful. And then the movie really ends quickly after that.
Right, because, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
Oh, yeah, because then there's the scene at the hospital, mm-hmm. and this goes with what you were saying, but also our earlier discussion of, like, queer kinship, because the nurse is like, or the doctor, whoever it is like, do you have arrangements, because you're the only relative or the only connection that he has. And on one level, I mean, it's profoundly sad to have reached mm-hmm. that point in your life, to have been such a key literary figure, and then to die with no family, with no friends, because obviously, I mean, Langston and Zora and everyone else has been dead by this point for 40, 50 years, which is sad in itself. But then, you know, the fact that it's Perry who takes up the burden and then who takes his ashes and scatters them at the ocean is, I think, a nice way to conclude this story, that sometimes, maybe most of the time, that it's only ourselves that we queer people can rely on, like that we're our family in mm-hmm. all the ways that matter. And I think that message was particularly resonant in 2004, which is still in the shadow of AIDS in a way that now is not. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's one of those really profoundly emotional moments that I think helps this film have such potency for me as a viewer, was that ending and what it suggests about their profound connection. Because they haven't known each other that long, but clearly there's been something really deep established between them.
And you know, I love a story where queers have a duty to each other.
That's right. And it's, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's a queer tragedy, because I don't know that Bruce's death is a tragedy per se. Like, it's, I mean, he's, you know, this seems
he's near the end of his life.
And I think he knows clear. That.
It's often, I mean, you could even go as far as to say that in some ways he lived to pass on a story to someone else. Right. And that he fulfilled that.
I like that reading.
It was beautiful. It got me.
Yep, me too.
Textured, standard definition and all. Got me.
Yep.
Got
me. I was like, I could feel myself. I wouldn't say that I was moved to tears, but I was moved in a very deep way. That mm-hmm. and not every queer movie moves me that way. But this one definitely did. Like, I emerged from this film just feeling very emotionally fulfilled.
Yeah, it made me want to write again.
I mean, I'm always writing, so yeah. But I understand, like, that it did present a life of queer creativity that is the ideal.
Yeah,
I mean, other than obviously being homeless.
Well, yes, but yeah, it like, I don't know. It gave me very fuzzy feelings about, because writing for them wasn't for, you know, well, yet fame or money or anything. They were trying to speak a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's it right there.
Yep.
And it had a whimsical kind of, not nihilistic, but like and it's actually exemplified in the film and portrayed this way, that at first it was because they were having fun and they wanted to do this thing because it was interesting, right? They wanted to make a message. It wasn't so much to build a career yet.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that Langston Hughes kind of shies away from them later on, is because he's become the voice of a generation, right?
Right. He wants a career as a writer.
Exactly. And Bruce kind of talks about how he sympathizes for Langston, because, you know, he said, I would never want to be that voice, because it comes with such a burden. which is also very interesting in terms of the idea, you know, of fame and fortune when it comes to writing.
Yep.
All right, now we're going to end the show the way we do every week with Are You Even Gay? And this week, I have an Are You Even Gay for TJ, and he doesn't have one for me. So it's going to be 5 to 10 minutes of me riffing about you, TJ, and how you aren't even gay.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, I've been waiting for this for a long time. So, TJ, I have to ask you this question before I ask you a different question. But so I know you've been paying attention to the news, and you heard about the tragic death of Sophie.
I had, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who fell trying to see the moon, I guess, is the story. But I hear that you didn't know who Sophie was.
Nope, saw it on the Twitter and thought, what? Who is this person? You know, so mm-hmm. I foraged about a bit to find out. But prior to that, I had never heard of this person mm-hmm. and was like, okay.
Well, I knew who Sophie was because, you know, I'm so young and vibrant and in the know.
Says the person who doesn't know usually what's going on gay Twitter. Where
you don't need to be on Twitter to know what's going on in this community.
I beg to differ.
All right. Well, so would everybody else, but I hold myself to that. Anyway, I was very sad to hear that they died. Excuse me, because you know Sophie is a very famous Scottish musician and producer. For those who don't know, they produced Charlie XCX for the White Gays. They also produced some of Kim Petras, I believe. And I'm just reading now on the Wikipedia that they produced some Madonna, which is interesting because they were only 34, excuse me.
Madonna has made music since the 80s, you know.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe something later on. But, you know, so clearly in the know, very, very famous, at least in the background. And they had their own album, which has great music that I love and have been, you know, and the reason why I bring it up too is because, I mean, you know, both of us have lost a lot this year and this past couple of years. And Sophie was a big part of those lives for me. And so there's a song that Sophie has that it's called It's Okay to Cry. And it's like this electronic song. It's very, very good. And it's one of her most popular ones. But anyway, very recently when in the like 30 degree weather, I went for a 6 mile run and just listened to that and kind of let myself know that it's okay to cry, you know? But they were very influential for me, and I really enjoyed them, and I was sad to see that they had died. So,
oh, that is very sad. It's always sad to lose people at such a young age.
Yeah. So anyway, I have to ask you, TJ, and it's a very me. Are you even gay? Because you know I'm brooding and sad. So,
TJ, what are you talking about? Like, I'm one of the most melancholic people that I know. Like, melancholy is my state of being.
I don't want to fight about who's more melancholic. But, you know, I didn't know about Designing Women or the Golden Girls, but I did know about this hipster musician who fell.
One doesn't have to be a hipster to be melancholic. And I would also remind... I would remind our listeners that I am a Pisces, and if any of the zodiac signs have a corner of the market of melancholia, it would be the Pisces. I'm just saying.
You can't have a monopoly on melancholia, Pisces. Okay.
I'm not saying it's a monopoly. Reason.
You're
I'm
all
just,
horrible. Yeah, saying. Here we go. Pisces pretending that everything that they do is so fucking original and they're the only ones that get to be sad. Newsflash. All the men I've ever dated before. Leos can be sad too.
I didn't say you couldn't. I'm just saying you don't get to Mr. Leo and everything is about me. You don't get to say that you're the most melancholic person ever.
Have you ever seen a lion be melancholic? It's very sad. Nobody ever cares what a fish looks like. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, you should listen to some of their music. It's actually pretty good.
And in answer to your question, yes, I am still gay, even if I haven't heard of something.
I didn't even ask the question yet. Oh. Excuse me. Don't steal my thunder. Okay, I'm going to start it again. TJ, are you even gay?
The last time I checked, yes.
That's good. I'm glad. I was worried for a minute.
No need to worry on that score. That's not changing anytime soon.
You should have you checked in with your your young Scottish friend about Sophie?
Oh, no. I did message them a while ago, but I haven't heard back.
Oh, okay. I wonder how they're all doing up there in that community.
Yeah.
I haven't asked mine, so.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so to conclude our show, we just wanted to talk a few minutes about the importance of Black History Month, which, as I referred to at the beginning of the pod, was the part of the reason we chose to do this film this month specifically. Obviously, we are of the belief that every month is Black History Month, that you cannot just put the black films in Black History Month. That is not what we're doing, and we want to make that clear, that we have a strong commitment to representing and discussing films of all kinds of queer experience throughout the year. We wanted to draw special attention because I think at the same time, I do think it's important that we acknowledge that February is Black History Month and we did not want to shortchange that. Which brings us to the rather difficult conversation we need to have about white gays and their continuing problems when it comes to issues of race. Because what struck us as we watched this film was how the conversations that take place in the classroom about police shooting unarmed black men, about the way in which white men continue to dehumanize black bodies. I alluded to Grindr earlier. If I had a dollar for every fucking Grindr profile that I saw with the abbreviation BBC from white boys in it, I'd be a fucking millionaire. And I live in a very small area, so I can only imagine what it's like in larger urban areas. Mm-hmm. So in honor of Black History Month and the importance of this film of highlighting these issues, Mark and I just wanted to remind white gays to not be awful. It really doesn't take that much to sort of learn how not to be ignorant when it comes to racial issues. And I'll be the first to say that I, too, am guilty in the past of having said or thought problematic things about in that regard. My boyfriend and partner is black, and he has definitely helped me understand the way in which I participate and racism in a way that I had not been before, and also has allowed me to really get a more emotionally resonant grasp about why these issues of police violence and other systematic oppressions matter more. Not that they didn't matter to me before, but I will say they do matter a great deal, or you gain an increased understanding and appreciation of them when your partner is black and you have to worry about them being pulled over for speeding, whether they're going to survive. Like, I do think that gives you a more profound awareness of these issues. And so I just wanted to take a few moments of our podcast to be annoying and political, but we're queers and all art and all life is political, so you can't get away from it. Mm. Like, that's our, I think, one of the core things that Mark and I agree on in terms of this pod, is that all things, particularly film and other cultural productions, are themselves implicated in politics and will always be.
Yeah, and it's like you said before, TJ, we all have growing to do. You never stop growing and understanding the parts of racism that you participate in, you know, willingly or not, unknowingly or not, and those are not excuses. And it's interesting watching this film and, you know, writing about black queer films and or just, you know, queer films in general, how much, I don't know, it's a huge learning experience that is also part of growing. And I think that I am excited to keep doing it, and I'm happy to take the time to talk about it with you, and that we make mistakes, and it's important to make those mistakes to figure it out. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And let me just be clear. Like, I don't want to be just the nagging school mother, but it's...
No,
just,
I didn't mean that.
But I think that Mark is right, that it is about growing and being open to new perspectives and new ways of changing instead of just being reactionary. And yeah, that's one of the things that I think is really important to emphasize, that especially in these very... I mean, we're living in a new era, thankfully. Like, the Biden era seems, at least in its early stages, to be an age in which we can at least be having these conversations in a way that involves respectful listening, and hopefully that will continue. I think that having a president who sets that example and having a vice president who is herself a woman of color, I think makes that, you know, a little easier than it was in the sort of white supremacy administration that we had before. And I just think that all of us are in this together, and we all bring our perspectives and our own lived experiences, but it's important to also understand and reach out to those who don't share that experience. Mm. And so I think it's particularly incumbent upon white gays who occupy a position of privilege, though they may not recognize it, to do that, to make themselves good allies. Like, we expect our straight friends to be good allies, and we need to be good allies for our black queer brethren and our black straight brethren as well.
Yeah. Especially as we learn, you know, as not learn, but as if people grow and more, you find that black women, black people of color, queer people of color are what the white gays have to, who are the white gays have to thank for a lot of their rights they have today.
Absolutely.
And that time and time again is proven over and over. So, you know, it's...
They go to bat for us. The least we can do is return the favor.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so thank you, everyone, for joining us for another episode of Queens of the Bees. Mark and I just want to thank all of you who have downloaded or shared our podcast. We really love this project, and we put a lot of heart into it. We genuinely enjoy it. Like, we
heart,
feel
soul,
very
blood, sweat, tears,
yep, time, semen. but we truly love doing this, and we love engaging with these films, and we love engaging with all of you. So to that end, if you can't get enough of us, you can follow us on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at TJWest3. You can also follow me on Instagram at ThomasWest3. And you can follow our podcast Twitter, which we aren't as active on, at Queens of the Bees. And then lastly, you can also, if you just cannot get enough of our commentary, you can follow our Medium publication. If you just type in Queens of the Bees Medium, it should take you right there. It's on Google. Take us right there. And there you'll find not only write-ups of what we've talked about on the pod, but a variety of other cultural queer commentary and political commentary that we've made. And lastly, if you'd like to donate, you can go to our Buzzsprout website and you can click on each episode, and there's a little link to go to share. Mark and I love doing this, but it would be even better to do it to get money. I apologize for the ugliness of the link. I can't get it to format properly, but I'm still trying. Mm. So hopefully I'll succeed in that effort. Mark, where can we find you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Muster the Courage without the E at the end. I would appreciate more followers, if nothing more than to spite TJ for saying that I'm not cool because I don't go on Twitter enough. And you can follow me on Instagram at Muster the Courage, completely spelled correctly. yeah.
Okay, and as always, as we make our exit stage right, we'd like to say, Eric Savini, if you're listening, we always have a seat open for you here on the podcast.
Hi.